It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. Maggie Turnbull was once called a genius by CNN. She's got an international profile and reputation for her work cataloging potentially habitable planets.
And now she chooses to work out of her own lab in the Northwoods of Anaga, Wisconsin at Global Science Institute. And she's with us now to talk about her love of the stars and where her work's going to take her next. Maggie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Great. Lovely up here today.
I bet it is. Up in the Northwoods, I can smell the pine trees already. Well, you're a freelance astrobiologist. Tell us what that means.
It depends on which day you ask me. But what it means is that I work in a similar manner to a lot of other so-called soft money scientists, which is that I work with a lot of different teams around the country, and funding for my survival comes from different grants coming from different proposals that we write, usually to NASA or the National Science Foundation. And when our proposals are selected, those are the projects that we're able to work on. So it's just a continual process of thinking of new ideas, finding new questions that are exciting and need to be addressed, and proposing to NASA and the NSF for funding to work on those things.
Now, you're a freelance astrobiologist based in Anaga, Wisconsin, of all places. And I'm curious as to how you got interested in this field in the first place. As I understand it, it goes back to when you were a child.
Yeah, I think I was kind of born this way. I remember my earliest memory of thinking about space was really as a very, very little kid. I think I might have been in kindergarten or first grade looking at a picture encyclopedia of the planets, and I remember there was a picture of Saturn in particular, which of course is such a visually striking planet. And you know, a little kid looking at that, what else, what is there in our everyday experience that's anything like that? But it was so interesting, and I would have been learning how to read at that point, too. And I think that I always was kind of drawn to that topic.
So this would have been one of those encyclopedias with the shiny paper where the whole planetary system kind of folded out, one of those things?
Well, in this one, if I could ever find it again, that would be really fun. In this one, there was a page, there probably was some kind of illustration like that, but in this one in particular, there was a page, a huge glossy color page devoted to each planet.
Ah, you got the nice encyclopedias, so, yeah.
Yeah, so Saturn had its own page. It might have been in black and white, actually. I don't even remember. It was so long ago.
So let me ask you this. I mean, when kids are that age, a lot of them are attracted to the planets. And yet you say, I was attracted to Saturn. I mean, it seems as though you had some predisposition right away that somehow this was an area that you'd be interested in.
Right. Well, I don't know if it's just attention to detail or being just sort of naturally intrigued with nature in general. I think that nature, whether it's, you know, looking at things in the woods or looking at the stars and planets, in my mind, that has always gone in the same category. I haven't really had a division in my thinking ever between nature on our planet and nature beyond our planet. If that makes any sense.
So nature beyond our planet. So you see those planets out there and you think of them as, you know, places that there could be other life. And that's just an extension of the world to you.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I think that I imagined when I was little that I would be an astronaut, and that in this mind, in my little world view, this was basically the same as like a field biologist going out into the desert and exploring, or only I would get into a slightly more complicated vehicle and go a little bit further and explore forests or who knows what on other planets, but that it was the same kind of work. at its core.
Now, I know that the Jodie Foster movie Contact had a really big effect on you. And this is the one where I think she makes first contact with alien life. And that changed the course of your own career. Do you remember what was going through your mind when you first saw that movie?
Yeah, I know that. So this was the summer after my junior year in college at UW-Madison, and I was spending the summer in Boston working at Harvard doing an internship, and I was getting sort of advanced enough in my studies where I felt pretty smart. And when that movie came out, I went to the movie thinking, I'm going to rip this movie to shreds. It's going to be so silly. I'm going to dissect everything that's wrong with it. I'm going to know so much about the stars, and there's no way that Hollywood could ever produce something that would be accurate. So I went to the movie prepared to kind of just be entertained and laugh all the way through, and hopefully not too annoyed at all the inaccuracies. But the movie was so engaging. I think that attitude probably lasted about 0.05 seconds, because that, especially with that opening scene where you start out with the sunrise over the limb of the Earth as seen from space, and start backing away from the Earth and go past the moon and past Mars, through the asteroid belt, there goes Jupiter, right through Saturn's rings, out of the solar system, and through the backing away, through the galaxy and other galaxies all the way out to the edge of the universe. That was incredible to see. And it was especially impactful to me. And this is just the first, 30 seconds of the movie. But it was especially impactful to me because, meanwhile, what you're hearing is the sound of Earth, the radio signals that have leaked off of the planet from humans. And as you get farther away, you hear things that were broadcast longer and longer ago. And the timing is all wrong in the movie, which annoyed me, but the important part was that you get to a certain distance, not even that far away, only past, the few hundred nearest stars, really, and there's silence, and there's nothing, and you're backing away in utter silence forever after. That was so impactful to me.
Maggie, I get the feeling you've seen this movie more than once. You know it pretty well.
I've seen it a couple times now.
And that led to your work with SETI, right?
Right. So after watching that movie, then the first time I saw it, especially, I was in such a change of frame of mindset about my own career path and my own future. I just felt so strongly at the end of the movie that this was something that was important, and that in all of astrophysics, of all the wonderful things there are in the universe to study, that this topic, in some ways it kind of went back to my childhood idea of just going other places and studying all the things that live there, that you kind of forget about in the course of your academic career. You get trained out of that original wide-eyed assumption that there's life everywhere. And the universe, when we dissect it with numbers, kind of becomes less alive to academics. But after seeing that, which is what was happening to me as a student, really, I was becoming very intellectual about it. But after seeing the movie, I realized that this was important. This was something that, looking for life on other planets, whether you're looking for plants or people, would be revolutionary if it were successful, if we were able to discover something like that, and that this is truly important to humanity. It's not just of intellectual curiosity.
I want to go from deep space back to Antigo, if we could, for a second. You mentioned Harvard. You've worked at the Carnegie Institution for Science in Washington, D.C., Baltimore Space Telescope Science Institute. You've had lots of opportunities, and yet you are in Antigo. How did that happen?
I guess I just got really lucky. I love being back in Wisconsin, and I don't know if I don't think I have had an opportunity to talk to you guys about this prior to the interview, but I'm actually going to be making a move to Madison in order to start teaching at the UW. Just one class, but I hope to still spend a really significant amount of time up in the Northwoods because it's just such a high quality of life. And at least for somebody like me who really loves the outdoors and just loves being immersed in life, you know, there's just so much going on here for the type of person who is fascinated by nature and ecosystems. And for me, one of the greatest joys of my life, just the happiest moments, are being in my kayak paddling down the Wisconsin River. And the fact that I have managed to still keep going, you know, with my science and at a level that I consider to be really, you know, at the highest level of science, at least in this field of astrobiology, to me demonstrates that it is possible to do the work that really is important to you and live in a place that you can love and not have to be separated from family, for example, which was one of the main reasons that I returned to Wisconsin. I just felt the real strong desire to come back to my roots here.
Well, that's well put, and we'll be happy to have you here in Madison, too. And we're talking right now with Maggie Turnbull, who is a freelance astrobiologist. She'll be teaching a class at the UW-Madison, though, coming up as well. She's based in Anago for the moment. And we're going to be talking about her love of space and her quest to search for habitable planets. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're picking up our conversation now with Maggie Turnbull. She's a freelance astrobiologist who runs her own lab from Antigo, Wisconsin. And Maggie, tell us about what you do when you are in your lab and you're looking for habitable planets out there in the solar system to get to your dream of making that first contact and getting people interested maybe in traveling further into space. What are you looking for?
Well, first of all, my lab really consists of me, my laptop, somewhere to sit, and a really good internet connection. That's my limiting factor. Other than that, I can pretty much work, set up shop anywhere. But what I'm looking at is a huge amount of data. So just picture kind of endless spreadsheets with columns and rows of numbers. And what I'm trying to sort out is what are the stars like, which sounds like such a simplistic question. But really, it's true that I am just trying to understand what the very nearest star systems are like. And could they be habitable to Earth-like life? And so the question really is each star system capable of hosting an Earth-like planet, or a planet anything like the Earth for that matter? And so I look at a lot of different characteristics of that system because, of course, we don't have the information, we don't have the data or the tools that we need to just take a really fabulous picture and see all the planets around every star right now at this time. My colleagues have developed some really fantastic techniques for finding planets, but they aren't capable at this time of finding Earth-sized planets as small as the Earth, located in what we call the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone around a star, where it could have liquid water, and actually take a picture of that planet or get some light from that planet in order to tell what it's like. You know, does it have weather? Does it have water? Does it even have, you know, maybe plants? Plants have been broadcasting their presence to the universe for more than a billion years just by the chlorophyll signature in their leaves. So we could potentially detect that, but that's going to require instrumentation that doesn't yet exist. And what we need to do is figure out how to design a mission that would be capable of finding Earth-like planets. And what we think that it's not too far beyond us, actually, technology-wise, but it's just a matter of putting the pieces together, launching the instrumentation into space, putting it in the right kind of orbit, and investing the time and pointing at the best possible stars for finding exo-Earths. And so what I do every day is I try to understand these stars and figure out which ones are going to be the ones that are, A, the easiest to find Earth-like planets around and actually take a picture, and B, which ones are even capable of having Earth. You know, a lot of stars are not single stars like the sun. They're actually double stars or triple stars. And that doesn't always rule out planets, but it might rule out planets, or it might make it really difficult to see planets in those systems. So I got to sort that all out for all the nearby stars. And even though you think that, oh, it's just one of the nearest stars, how could that be hard to study? It turns out that every single one of these systems is totally unique. And stars haven't really been that interesting to astronomers for a long time. Astronomers have been more interested in dark matter and dark energy and black holes and cool things like that. So the very nearest stars, it really still is ongoing just to put together a complete picture of what they're like.
So how do you rule out a star system or a star that's not a good candidate for what you're looking for? I mean, all I can draw back on is that cliche about billions and billions of stars out there. But how do you do that? Yeah. How do you sift through all that?
Well, a lot of it, quite honestly, is just simply compiling high-quality data. That in itself, just so you can begin making decisions like that, that's kind of step zero. And step zero, just getting the quality data in the first place, is fairly time-consuming. And so that's really what we're tackling right now in a much more energetic way in my field. Like, once and for all, we want to just get sorted out. What are the nearest stars, and what's the highest quality data that we have for each one of those systems? Then we can start doing, we can actually start ruling things out or in. But as far as ruling things out, we want to try to be really open-minded. So unless there's something that is either going to make it impossible for us to even search that star, for example, say you have a star like the very nearest star system, Alpha Centauri, that has a beautiful sun-like star. It's just very similar to our own sun. And orbiting tightly with that star is a second star, Alpha Sun B, which is slightly fainter. And we actually do know now that it does have a small planet in a tight orbit around it. But those two stars orbit each other fairly closely. So in order to take a picture of planets in that system, it's going to be really complicated just because you have so much light from the other star shining into your telescope and making it much harder to see the Earth, the tiny little tiny speck of light coming from an Earth-like planet if it's in that system.
And Megan, we've only got about a minute left, but I'm sure you've imagined the day that you find that planet that is habitable for life, maybe that has life already. In your mind, what is that day like?
Oh, my goodness. That day is the beginning of a lot of days where we're trying to make sense of how it is that the universe can be so diverse and yet so familiar to us at the same time, to actually find other living creatures on another planet that I have no doubt in my mind is going to be very different from our own because the diversity in the universe is just so great.
I hope we all are there to see it. It sounds amazing. Maggie, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
That was astrobiologist Maggie Turnbull. She runs Global Science Institute from Anago, Wisconsin. She also told us she'll be heading up to Madison to be teaching at the UW in the not-so-distant future. Coming up, we'll find out how climate change may be eating into some of the pollution gains in northern Wisconsin lakes. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You've been listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here this week for Rob Ferret, and happy Friday, everybody. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and we're already gearing up for corn season. So, Veronica, how do you prepare corn?
I don't know. I'm not much of a corn aficionado, but I think I would just boil it with some sugar and some butter and some salt. What about you?
I like mine frozen out of a plastic bag. I'm kidding. Gosh, you guys, you're so serious. I like mine grilled over charcoal in the husks and then with about a gallon of butter. That's how I like it.
Yeah, a gallon of butter is
And then
cute.
Some salt. It's bad for my heart, but it's worth it.
Well, we'll get to that and your heart and all that good stuff in just a moment. But first, the curtain is going up in a northern Wisconsin lake, and that means a nearly 30-year research effort into air and water pollution is winding down. Chuck Kornbach has more about what scientists have learned from both halves of Little Rock Lake.
It drew national attention in 1984 when scientists from the UW, DNR, and other agencies lowered a plastic curtain into a pristine, hourglass-shaped lake in the Northern Highland American Legion State Forest. The barrier blocked water and effectively split Little Rock Lake into two basins. To simulate the acid rain that fell over parts of the U.S., research boats like this one sprayed acid into one of the basins. The other basin was largely left undisturbed as a natural monitor of the changing environment. This week, the DNR announced the long-term research project will come to an end on July 29th, when the plastic curtain is removed. Researchers say they learned a lot over the last 30 years. The UW's Tim Kratz says during the 6 years of acidification, some troubling things were found.
The fish community was affected in that the largemouth bass in the lake were unable to reproduce during the time of the maximum acidification. There were large algal mats that occurred on the bottom of the lake, and the plankton community changed dramatically.
Kratz says most of the effects confirmed what other researchers had found comparing different types of lakes. He says after the acid dumping stopped, Little Rock Lake eventually recovered chemically. Along the way, the findings helped shape a Wisconsin acid rain law that reduced sulfur dioxide emissions from coal-burning power plants. That law later influenced the 1990 Federal Clean Air Act amendments. As a diver collected water samples from Little Rock Lake, scientists were also making other discoveries at the Vilas County site. The DNR's Carl Watrous says a few years into the acidification, it became clear that mercury concentrations in small fish were going up. Most of the mercury was coming from the burning of coal. Watrous and others found that as the lake became more acidic, a toxic form of the mercury accumulated more in fish species.
So by increasing the loading of sulfate to the system, we're inadvertently fueling this methylmercury cycle. When you couple those two together with the atmospheric deposition of acid rain and acid deposition of mercury through mercury rain, you kind of get a double hit on the system.
Watrous says he hopes a Wisconsin mercury rule passed a few years ago will also succeed in better protecting fish and the people and critters that eat them. As boats travel the lakes of the north, the UW's Tim Kratz says there's at least one more project at Little Rock that's made a difference. Kratz says in one basin they removed trees that had fallen into shallow water and assessed how fish reacted.
We lost yellow perch. The largemouth bass started to grow much more slowly, and their diets shifted.
Kratz says the findings confirm that wood in shallow water is often great habitat, and that's helped shape best practices for managing lake shorelines. Despite the beneficial findings from Little Rock Lake, the DNR's Carl Watrous is concerned about one thing, that climate change, when it triggers less precipitation, has dropped water levels in northern lakes. So Watrous says Little Rock's acid and methyl mercury levels have been going back up. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And we're joined by Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio News Now. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Well, Chuck, 30 years, that's an awfully long time. Why an experiment of this length? What did they find out?
Well, I think you have to go back to why this got started. And it wasn't all just one type of experiment. They happened to make use of this curtain for 30 years. But, you know, it got started when acid rain was a major concern in the late 70s, early 80s, in a lot of the northern U.S. and Canada. And so I think it helped to have a governor at the time, Tony Earle, who had been a DNR secretary, and a DNR secretary, Buzz Bozadny, who believed in strong science, and they had support from the legislature, and this survey got underway with the acidification. And as I say, it then moved into, they then found what the effect of the mercury, the greater acid on the mercury was, and then they later on, after the acidification efforts was pretty much done, they moved on to this woody shoreline issue.
So how valuable is this research coming out? Have they found things that they didn't expect?
Well, it partly confirmed some things that were going on elsewhere, but it partly confirmed things in sort of one lake where they had this, you know, as I say, it was very unusual at the time to have this plastic curtain drop down. It had floats on the top and was held down by sandbags. To have this all done in one lake and right here in Wisconsin, and it drew a lot of attention. So it confirms some things. It confirms some things in one lake, and it as there was this effort in Wisconsin to begin dealing with acid rain by cutting sulfur dioxide emissions from power plants, some of the findings, I think, helped shape the debate there. And then once the Wisconsin law passed, it became a national model, and even under the first President Bush, the Clean Air Act was amended, and they, to some degree, they looked to Wisconsin, to what Wisconsin's law had done, and it helped shape national sulfur dioxide emission cuts, which, generally speaking, are viewed well by the public, I think.
So it's been an influential study.
Well, I think you could argue that it has. The DNR certainly is publicizing it this week and hoping to say that it worked. The scientists say they are very proud of the work they did. I've never heard any criticism of the work they did, and you know, you can, I suppose, debate, and there's people that don't view restrictions on power plants all that favorably. I suppose there's some folks that might debate some of the findings, but I've generally never heard of any serious criticism of the research methods and approach that was done up there.
Well, and I guess one thing we know from the 30-year experiment that we are not able to really crack at this point is that lower water levels mean increased mercury, and that's something that sounds like is just going hand-in-hand with climate change.
Well, yeah, and the way that works is that Mr. Watrous was saying that there's a lovely phrase they use, the mobilization of legacy sulfur in exposed lake sediments. In other words, the sulfur that fell years ago has been exposed by when the water levels drop, and when rain or snow melt comes along, washes the sulfur into the water. There's some likely effect on loons in these lakes, but fortunately this year with the water levels up a bit, perhaps there's less of this washing in, but it's a concern if climate change generally continues to bring dry conditions to the north.
Well, Chuck, it's an interesting piece of work. What do you think is going to happen when they take that piece of plastic away?
Well, they've got a big ceremony planned on July 29th, and they're inviting the media in. It's going to be a return to one ecosystem, so to speak, as they're saying, and more research, I think, will be done up there. It's still a valuable sentinel lake, as they call it, a research lake. It'll just be without the curtain.
Are you going to be there?
I'm sure WPR will be there, put it that way.
Excellent. Well, Chuck, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
That was WPR's Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio News, based in Milwaukee.
Coming up next, we'll be checking the headlines, and then it's Food Friday. Today, we're discussing that Wisconsin favorite, corn. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Food Friday, and that means it is time to get inspired for our weekend cooking. And since we're knee-deep in Wisconsin's growing season, today we are going to be talking about corn.
Ian Knauer is a former Tet's Kitchen cook for Gourmet Magazine and the author of a cookbook called The Farm. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
So great to have you on again. And I know that you grow pretty much everything on your farm, and how's your corn looking?
This year has been pretty good for the corn. We got a lot of rain early on, and it likes that. And then we got a lot of heat, so it sort of it decided to come a little bit early this year. I'm over in eastern Pennsylvania, so I don't know how things are in Wisconsin, but probably similar, I would guess.
Yeah, we haven't quite come into the fullness of corn season yet, but it's definitely something that people look forward to. You know, we've got a lot of corn festivals and corn recipes, and I guess corn is such a versatile ingredient these days that, you know, it's time to think of new things to do with it.
That's right, yeah. Corn is one of those things, I actually forget about it until it's corn season again, probably because I eat so much of it this time of year that, you know, in a month and or 6 weeks from now, I'm so sick of it that I don't need to see it until next summer. But recently I've been walking through my garden and other farmers markets, and it's just piled high right now, sort of in these huge pyramids of corn. So I get really excited for it.
So, you know, when you're walking through those farmers markets, how do you go about picking out a sweet ear? I see some people, you know, peeling back the husks and looking at the kernels. What do you look for?
I have a confession to make. I actually taste it.
Is that allowed?
I'm not sure it's allowed, and I'm not sure that the farmers at the farmers market would encourage you to do this, because if you don't like it, you may not want to buy it. But I peel it back, and with my thumb, I burst one of the kernels, and then I taste it. And what I'm tasting for is sweetness, and I also am on the lookout for starchiness. And if it's starchy, then I don't want it. You know, I want my sweet corn to be sweet. It's one of those vegetables that as soon as you take it off the stalk, it starts to convert its sugars into starch. So the longer it's off the stalk, the worse it is, and you want to make sure that it's as fresh as possible.
So what do you mean by starchy?
So literally, you can sort of taste it on your tongue. If you ever have, let's say you take some cornstarch that you can buy at the store, and you mix it with water, it's almost granular if you taste it, if you don't cook it. And so that's what I'm on the lookout for. I want to make sure that it hasn't progressed to that stage yet and it's still quite sweet.
So you want your sweet corn sweet?
Yes.
It's interesting because we do serve some corn sweet. I've seen sweet corn souffles that do have clearly sugar added, but you can also go savory with it. Which way are you inspired these days?
Well, I like both. In this time of year, I like to pair the corn, because it's so naturally sweet, with something salty to help balance it. So, for instance, just 2 days ago, I got some really fresh corn, and I threw it right on the grill. I didn't even shuck it. I kept it in the husk and put it right on the grill, let it steam in its own juices. And then, after it was cooked, I peeled it, and actually I made everybody else peel their own, because that's one of the things that I hate about corn is just shucking all this corn. So I just bring it right to the table. Everyone takes their own ear, peels it, and then I served it with a really salty herb butter that was some cilantro, some lime zest, some lime juice, some salt, some pepper, and a shallot. And I mashed that up all in the butter. And then everybody could just sort of slather that on their own ear of corn.
Wow, that sounds pretty good. And I like the idea
it's
of people shucking
yeah.
their own corn. And then it still has all that, the corn silk is still inside and everything, right?
That's right. And actually, that adds a lot of flavor. If you shuck your corn first and then cook it, you're missing out on all these sort of deep, earthy flavors that the silk and the husk bring to the flavor of the corn. In fact, corn silk tea is an old remedy for a cold. You know, if you take the corn silk and make a tea out of it, it's supposed to be good for you. I don't know if that's actually true. I think it's an old wives' tale.
You haven't tried it yet.
I haven't tried it yet.
I'm surprised, actually, with everything else
I do actually take corn when I have a cold, but usually that's in the form of whiskey. So,
Slightly different treatment of the corn there. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, I would suspect that you're not squeamish about such things. But for me, if I don't shuck the corn, I'm worried that one of my guests, or God forbid me, is going to get that fat green cornworm.
That's the best thing that can happen. That means that your corn hasn't been sprayed with pesticides. So, you know, I mean, I always take bugs as a good sign. If the bugs can live, then it's probably a better piece of produce.
So I will tell you that on the 4th of July, I made your recipe again. So this is the second annual making of Ian Knauer's corn and potato salad. And it was excellent again, 2 years in a row. And it's so simple. You just boil some potatoes and you boil your corn with the potatoes and then some herbs, some apple cider vinegar. And it was great.
Yeah, it's so simple, too. And I think what the corn adds to that salad is a nice pop of sweetness. You know, it sort of balances that acidity from the vinegar, and the richness of the potatoes is, you know, I mean, I love potato salad straight, but to add that extra element, and it's so easy to do by just throwing a couple handfuls of corn kernels in there.
Now, you sent a new recipe for us today. What is that one?
This is a raw corn salad, and it's very important that you have fresh corn for this because you don't want it to be starchy. You want it to be sweet, and you want it to, you know, when you get really fresh corn, it just pops when you chew it. That's what you're looking for here. So if you have super fresh corn, all you have to do is take it off the cob and toss it like you would lettuce. So I put some red onion in there, some basil, and then a real simple vinaigrette, some lemon juice, olive oil, salt, and pepper. I toss that all together, season it to taste. And it's one of those salads that people haven't had before, so it sort of has this wow factor. You know, I mean, not many people have had a raw corn salad.
Yeah.
When you taste it, it really, really lets that sweetness come through. It's a fun salad. It's a simple salad. And also, there's a really great technique written into that recipe. You know when you take corn off the cob and the kernels bounce all over your kitchen?
Yeah.
I mean, that happens every time you do it. So a really simple way to prevent that is to take a kitchen towel and put it on your work surface, and then cut the kernels down off the cob, and the kitchen towel prevents them from bouncing around. If you don't use that, they just bounce all over your cutting board. But the kitchen towel somehow softens their fall and keeps them all together. Then
really?
You pick up the kitchen towel and transfer it all over to a bowl and dump it in there.
I have to say, I was picking up a lot of corn kernels off my kitchen floor when I made your potato salad. So this is good. Now you tell me about the towel technique.
Right. For next
That's
year.
Excellent. Yeah, so raw corn salad, I don't know. So you don't have to cook it at all, but it must depend on the quality of the corn that you get.
That's exactly right. And this is one of those recipes that is very dependent on super fresh corn, super fresh produce. And since we're coming into the season, you know, it's a great way to show it off. If you get corn that's a day old or 2 days old, I would cook it. And, you know, I would do it as simply as possible, just throw the whole thing, like I explained before, on the grill. Husk and all. And then that helps sort of temper the starchiness a little bit. But when it's really fresh, I like to eat it raw.
So we've been talking about pretty, you know, rustic ways to eat corn, raw corn salad and corn on the grill. What if you wanted to fancy up your corn? What would you do?
One of the things that I like to do is make corn soup. And I do that a couple different ways. It depends on who's coming over for dinner. I have a sister who doesn't eat dairy. So if she's coming, I'll use a water-based soup, and I'll add the corn, and I'll blend some of it, and then maybe even thicken it with a little bit of additional corn starch, depending on how thick I want it. And then I like to serve that cold, and I like to serve it cold with a red chili jelly that's sort of loosened up a little bit. And that way you sort of get the pepper, the spicy, the sweetness of the corn, and it's a really nice sort of alternative to something like gazpacho, but you get to have this refreshing summer soup.
Oh, that sounds nice. Is that complicated?
It's actually pretty simple, but it's because you blend it, it has sort of an elegance to it. It seems, when you're eating it, like it's more complicated than it actually is.
Maybe just an immersion blender will do the trick, huh?
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, and I should point out before we go too much farther that we do have your raw corn salad recipe up on our Central Time Facebook page if you'd like to check that out as soon as that corn gets going in your cooking list. So you can go over to the Central Time Facebook page. And Ian, now didn't you say you had a new inspiration about planting corn, the way you actually grew your own corn this time around?
So this is something that I have never tried before, and I decided to give it a go in part of my garden this year. It's growing vegetables, corn included, in straw bales. So what I did early spring, I bought a couple straw bales at my local ag store, and I put them in my garden, and I sprinkled them with fertilizer. And you can use any fertilizer that you want. I use 10-10-10, but if you want to use an organic fertilizer or blood meal or whatever, you can do that. Sprinkle them with that, and then soak them with a hose. And get them good and soaked through, and then let them sit outside for about 4 to 6 weeks. Now, again, this is early spring, so this was March sometime for me. What happens in those 4 to 6 weeks is they start to decompose. They start to compost themselves from the inside out, and the fertilizer helps with that. And then when it's time to plant, you put just an inch or two of topsoil on top. And I kept these straw bales tied up. They're still tied up.
So we've got about 10 seconds. Sorry, Ian.
Okay. So what happens is you plant the veggies, including the corn. The corn goes down into the straw bales. You don't have any weeds because it's straw. There's no seed in it. And secondly, it's 2 feet off the ground, so the critters stay away. It's actually working out really well.
Wow. Well, that sounds like a technique to try. Well, Ian Knauer, thank you so much for coming and talking corn today.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
Ian Knauer is the author of the cookbook called The Farm. And you can check out that recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up Monday on Central Time, according to a new study, it turns out parents do want to live through their children no matter what they say.
That's right. And we will be checking on that and a lot more on Central Time.